OYOTU.com.
Sign Language with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 154 of Sign Language. I got an email from Ernie following up from the last episode. He said, "Hey Bruce, thanks for the suggestion to Isotope RX. I'll try the trial and see, and I noticed the older versions are quite a bit cheaper, but would not be opposed to a new version if I could catch it on sale. I downloaded a trial of Audition CS5.5, I think it was, and went to insert a MIDI track and couldn't find it. So I Googled how to. Needless to say, I learned it had been removed, and after your podcast, I researched for support on if Audition CC had it, and it seems to be missing as well. Yeah, mate, thanks for the input. I'll pay attention to that next time. That video took me almost 3 days. The video I sent you was my first time editing video in Sony Movie Editor, and separately recorded audio together. I think you might have been talking about the first 10 minutes with the waterfall. I had the most issues with that one because it was the only part where I had two separate stereo audio tracks and the waterfall was overpowering the birds and bugs. Since it was my first time, I think I mucked something up with the audio. As at the time, Sony was stuck on snap to grid lines and I didn't realise at the time you could turn that off. Insert hand on forehead facing down here. Interestingly enough, the scene was two stereo tracks, but at the same spot, I recorded with the H1 using a mono Presonus mic, pointing towards the waterfall, then turned around behind a man-made rock wall, pointing to a field for the birds part, using just the H1 built-in mics. Now that I have an H4N, I can record four tracks at once, using the two built-in and two external mics. So that would make that part easier. And I actually prefer using two mono mics to make my own stereo field. I find it neat that I can create what I want people to hear by splitting the mics as far apart or as close as I want. Arguably, some would say that too far apart negates the stereo field effect. Anyways, as far as the mics question goes, my fault, I guess I failed to state. I wasn't necessarily asking for my use cases, but more along the lines of, do you pay attention to the specs of a mic, such as sensitivity, signal-to-noise ratio, or SPL for a specific use case, or even in general? Thanks, and I'll stop feeding the bears.
I'm sort of in that boat, Ernie, where the width of the mics... I guess it's an artistic thing, you know. Yes, if you have them, you know, anything more than probably a foot apart, then you're certainly exaggerating, you know, the quote-unquote stereo field. Because really, our sense of stereo as human beings is what we perceive through our ears, which are, I think the general consensus is about 17 centimetres, which is a little over 6 inches apart. You know, so obviously, you know, if you move the microphones to a point where they're, you know, 6 feet apart from each other, then obviously the stereo image that they record will have no real-world comparison to what any human being would hear. But, like I said, it's an artistic approach, you know, and to my mind, it's a valid approach if it meets your goal. You know, I think it comes down to the fact that any art, and let's face it, recording audio is an art, is subjective. And, you know, with photography, we're always saying, hey, if it looks good, it is good. And I think the same can be said of sound. If it sounds good, it is good. You know, all that matters is that, A, you were able to get your audio vision for, I know that's a horrible analogy, but that you were able to get what you imagined in your head recorded and mixed and presented to the listener, you know, along the lines of what you imagined. If you're able to do that and it sounds good to you, then, you know, from a subjective point of view, it works and it is what you were chasing. Whether or not the rest of the world likes it is a completely different kettle of fish. Yeah. So anyway, that's my two cents on that. As for your last paragraph about microphones, when I'm picking a mic, yeah, I'm kind of at a point where, you know, I generally know what microphones I would love to have. And it usually comes down to polar patterns more than anything else. You know, I want cardioid stuff. I want figure eight stuff. Figure eight mics are obviously handy for when you want to reject signals. You know, omnidirectionals have their time and their place. As for sensitivity, signal to noise ratio, no, I can't say I really would spend a great deal of time reading that stuff. I sort of, just from experience, know generally which brands are the better brands. So I take it on faith that, you know, anything that comes from one of the trusted brands is probably going to have pretty good specs. And beyond that, I actually think, you know, the beauty of the internet is being able to get peer submitted reviews. You know, you go to any website, you know, where you can buy any of this product, whether it be Amazon or Sweetwater or whatever, you can usually find this is what people who bought this product are saying about it, type links, you know, and comments and things like that. And I think, you know, that is the real strength of the internet, is being able to get third-party opinions, you know, from people who don't have a vested interest in the product. Okay, admittedly, some of them may have a vested interest in the sense that they've laid down their money and now they have to justify the purchase, but that's different to manufacturers and or retailers who are trying to get money out of your pocket and into theirs. I would much prefer to read the opinions and reviews of someone who has bought a microphone than read the opinions of the manufacturer or the retailer who are trying to flog it. Okay, so that's just my take on picking mics. Yeah, I guess, you know, everyone's got to work within, obviously, their budget, and, you know, it helps to know what you want to record. And, you know, what, like I said, to me, polar pattern is probably more important than anything else. And after polar pattern, it would be transduction method. You know, is it dynamic? Is it ribbon? Is it condenser? Is it an electric condenser? Those sorts of things might come into it next. But yeah, polar pattern first and foremost, I'd say, for me. Alrighty, moving on. I have had two absolutely epic emails from Rob Bettler, which I'm not going to get through today. I will get through one of them, Rob. And this was an interesting one. It was, and we've sort of started venturing into this topic, I think, before I killed the podcast off 3 years ago. This email is called False Surround Dictatorships. Rob says, I'm sure you've seen them. Everybody's talking about them, and perhaps that's the problem. You can only talk about them instead of buying or renting one. I'm talking about the many VR headsets, such as the HTC Hive, the Oculus Rift, and Google's Project Tango. Thing is, that old and tired VR promise has long remained unfulfilled. More specifically, companies have been flogging that poor dead VR donkey since the mid-90s, which makes it difficult to believe them, unless, of course, you consider Google has also invested around $600 million not only in VR tech, but also in a similar technology called Magic Leap. Google would not have invested that much money if the technology was not significantly better. Besides Magic Leap, Google even partnered with GoPro to create a revolutionary device to capture truly immersive experiences. It sounds amazing, but the 16 GoPro cameras are a complete letdown. It looks like an improvised merry-go-round for your 16 GoPros. As if those dinky cameras needed their own tacky amusement park. I'm not joking. Their jump device looks like a crudely put together merry-go-round of cameras. Is the result worth the merry-go-round abomination? Well, kinda. After you've captured the video, the viewer can pan front, back, right, left, and even up and down, like this video inside a fighter jet cockpit. And I'll put the link in the show notes. Granted, the video inside the fighter jet is very interesting until you realise it's a highly glorified video version of one of those 360 pictures on Flickr you've been able to pan and pan for at least the last 6 years. Of course, there are far more elegant solutions, such as Lytro Emerge, which, in a nutshell, records the 3D models of whatever is in front of it by analysing the light
showering over the object. The resulting data is so heavy they give you several terabytes in a mini server sold with their 3D camera. All of the above are truly amazing technologies to capture 3D images of objects, right? But what happened to the audio? Not so much. Actually, I wish any of the above companies had been developing an equivalent 3D technology to capture immersive audio at all. You see where this is going, right? All of the cited websites, the Lytro Emerge, the Oculus Rift, the HTC Vive, or even Google's backed projects, failed to make mention of that which sign language is all about. Audio. At some point, I was very hopeful to find any or all of those companies were also developing a revolutionary companion device to capture audio the way they're planning to capture video and volumetrics. And guess what? I'm ashamed of myself for being so gullible. None of those giants seems to realize that immersive experiences have to include audio for them to qualify as truly immersive. If their aim is fooling the senses enough to make the users forget the experience isn't real, audio should not be ignored. Audio is almost as essential as video to deceive the senses for entertainment purposes. At some point, I was truly expecting a set of microphones that would capture in 360. A silent drone with 16 microphones or something as exotic as their crappy 16-camera merry-go-round abomination. Something audio-related that would let you fly around in X, Y, and Z and explore the audio landscape. But I had zero luck because I could not find any companion audio projects comparable to the very ambitious ones being developed for video. Look at the cockpit video. The video panning controls are like a sore thumb in the top left corner, and you can pan the video somehow freely, but the audio? Zero panning, zero controls. Almost as if to them, audio's not even an afterthought. This severe lack of development in audio technologies to complement VR projects only looks abysmal when we take into consideration the splurge these companies have indulged in while developing some of these visual technologies. We're talking about billions dedicated to VR video, not to audio. See, these glaring omissions remind me of a sharp and accurate comment by a farmer many years ago when he was criticizing a politician. The farmer in question said with legendary simplicity, "Nah, he won't do it. He's a talker, not a doer." Let me extrapolate what that sharp farmer said to this conversation. Gimmick products are the talkers, while the doers are solid, useful technologies like smartphones. In this case, I think that VR technologies are mere talkers, not doers. To date, I remain unconvinced VR technologies are more than just gimmicks, especially because of their glaring omission of comparable audio technologies. Immersion should not belittle our sense of hearing. For all of the above reasons, I think VR tech may be just glorified gimmicks.
Going to jump in here and say, I am 100% with you, Rob. I am yet to be convinced of the value of VR. I'm sure it'll get there, but I think it's a long way off. Look at how long it took 3D to get anywhere. You know, forget about VR, just come back to 3D. You know, they had us sitting there with blue and red goggles on 30 years ago, and it's just getting to somewhere close to being usable now. So I personally think VR is a long way off. It probably won't take another 30 years, but it'll probably take another 10 or 15. That's my take. Anyway, moving on.
Granted, my opinion may change as soon as I watch my first 8K or 4K VR porn. What? Porn's never revolutionized technologies? Of course it has, but that's beyond the scope of this rant. After my disillusionment with all VR technologies, I did what most geeks do. I kept looking, and I found something you'll probably hate me for. Virtual 7.1 surround headphones. More specifically, these two, the Logitech G35 and the Razer Kraken 7.1. Why the hate? Well, probably because after all the blood, sweat, and tears it cost you to learn how to mix in 5.1, now, like many gamers, I went all the way to 7.1, and now your meager 5.1 is so beneath my magnificent 7.1 gaming headphones with luxurious fake surround that now I demand you and Chad upgrade your mix to 7.1 or else I won't listen to it. Yeah, like that demand was gonna fly. But the insult upon the audio injury? Oh, this blasphemous Mexican-Canadian had the audacity of joining the unholy virtual surround gamer cult. I'm so ashamed of myself. Please don't hate me too much, dear Audio Senpai. I have paper-thin walls and hypersensitive cranky neighbours too. Also, the porn I watch is too noisy. Jokes aside, this situation is not uncommon. An audio engineer has no real control over what kind of hardware will be used to listen to his work, and the virtualized surround is just another layer of complexity because it's not even real physical surround. Granted, how many customers have properly calibrated 5.1 systems? How about soundproofed living rooms? It is not like most mixers are going to be heard in anechoic chambers. The mix may be stellar, but the end user's hardware may often be lackluster.
I'm just going to jump in here, Rob, and say, yeah, that is one of the major issues that we have, is that, yes, we can go to all these great lengths to produce, you know, a nice 5.1 mix of, you know, whatever project we happen to be working on. But we as audio engineers have no control over, you know, what playback hardware is used, nor the environment in which that playback occurs. But that's always been the case, you know, with any recorded audio, even from the days of recording in mono. You know, stuff was recorded in a studio and it was generally a big band, you know, playing into one ribbon mic that was, you know, 8 feet away from the entire band, and it was, you know, a recording captured on one mic of a live performance. And even though the band might have been playing in a beautiful studio, you know, with, you know, nice natural acoustics, there was no control over how that was heard back. You know, generally that signal would have been transmitted over AM radio, and, you know, people were sitting around their old, you know, what were they, Victorolas or whatever they were called, you know, these wooden boxes with a single speaker in them, you know, listening to the radio on a Sunday night as a family, as was the custom, you know, 60 odd years ago. So it's always been the case that, you know, no matter what degree to which you strive to get the perfect recording and the perfect mix, you've still got no control over how that material's heard back. I mean, even today, you know, artists will spend admittedly considerably less now than they did, say, in the 80s and 90s for professional studio time, because these days, you know, many artists are either A, producing content at home and then simply getting it mixed in a good studio and then mastered, or, you know, if you're in the electronic dance music scene, you don't even need a studio because it's all samples and, you know, manipulation, and that can be done on a laptop with a pair of headphones, right? So there are a whole bunch of reasons for why the production of an album is a lot cheaper now than it used to be. However, great lengths are still being gone to make, you know, as good a product as, you know, the artist and or their, you know, recording engineer, mix engineer / producer is able to achieve. And good artists will get their material mastered as well by a professional mastering engineer, so that there's a consistency to all of the tracks on an album, although we could argue that the album format's dying. But for all that, we have no control over, you know, the millions of Walking Dead who are navigating the planet with those yucky white earbuds stuck in their ears, listening to a 128 kilobit MP3. So, you know, we still have that problem. You know, you can go to great lengths to make a great product, but you still have no control over the hardware it's played back on or the environment in which it's consumed. You know, and certainly audio consumed in a mobile context, you know, whether you're sitting on a bus or on a train or walking down the street, walking through a shopping center, that is far from, you know, the best playback environment, and certainly not what the artist intended at the time that they produced the content. Same could be said for my podcast. You know, I sit in my little home studio here and I don't need to yell at the top of my voice because I have a great microphone and preamp and all the hardware. But when it comes to playing this back, if you're in a very noisy environment, you're probably going to have the volume turned up a little bit louder than you would like, simply to hear me, because I'm not talking, you know, like I'm not shouting. So anyway, I'm getting off the track. Back to Rob's email.
To feel a little less guilty, what I'm planning on doing is the following. I want to listen to Chad's film, whenever it comes out, in both real and virtualized surround. The idea is to see how far off the virtualized technology truly is. So far, I think it may be 50% gimmick and 50% useful technology. You remember the farmer's quote on how some people are just talkers and some are just doers? I'm still not sure if virtualized surround is just a talker, aka a mere gimmick. But your mix may help me decide. The reality is that we as a species hear and surround by nature, but perplexingly, the technology we use most often for music, podcasts, or movies has not really caught up. We basically listen to most of our audio in loud and eccentric forms of stereo, but those eccentricities are still just glorified stereo. Wouldn't it have made more sense that at this time in history we listen to everything in surround? See, that's the other problem, because the idea of virtualized surround is limited by the size of the headphones. Yes, you can try to do some psychoacoustic tricks with tiny earbuds or just one driver, but there allegedly are differences. Correct me if I'm wrong, but what I've read so far is that headphones have more room for both bigger drivers or several of them, usually three per side. The evidence I've seen so far is that size matters, and the audio trickery doesn't work as well with earbuds because they're too small, despite their claims. Another hurdle is that surround for podcasts would be overkill because, as you have previously pointed out, the human voice is mono. That's it. Imagine tomorrow Samsung worked out the kinks and all their phones or tablets came with surround earbuds. Imagine the technology made everything sound convincingly surround-ish. Imagine the learning curve of people getting used to virtualized surround, the distractions and the accidents while getting used to it. Which brings us full circle to people like you. Surround is not done intuitively. Audio engineers have to put together the mixes. But let's imagine just for a second, the hardware existed to record that kind of audio and 5.1 engineers became irrelevant. What would intuitive surround look or sound like? Well, ideally, people would have a panner on their audio players and they would possibly have the choice to freely move around a room where the podcast was recorded. Imagine you could move around the room or around outdoor recordings too. Imagine exploring the audio atmospheres like a silent fly or like the 3D video technologies are trying to do and freely move in all the X, Y, and Z axes. That would be very interesting, but sadly that technology does not exist, at least not for us the uninitiated. But guess what? That nifty idea of being able to freely navigate a sound landscape already kind of exists and is widely used in video games.
All right, I'm going to stop it there because the email goes on for a bit longer. But I want to throw in a couple of ideas here. Yes, video game audio design is absolutely amazing. I'm not a gamer. There's probably only one game or series of games that I like to play, and that's the Dirt series that used to be called Colin McRae Dirt, which is a driving game. Some of the sound design in that is just absolutely amazing, and I know that some of the games that Max plays, my son, the sound design is phenomenal. You know, and as you pan your character's view, then the position of sound sources within the environment changes according to where your character is now looking. Yeah, so things like that are fantastic. As for the idea of music, podcasts, and movies having that degree of user operability, not sure about that, Rob. I think that's probably a long way off. Think also about the idea that how are you going to record? I mean, yeah, maybe it's not about recording. Maybe it's about real-time processing of the audio mix during playback. You know, if the user has the opportunity to pan the video, then maybe we need virtualized, you know, reflections and reverbs to change, you know, the position and the audio cues of a sound as that sound moves according to where we've happened to look in the video. Does that make sense? So if we pivot from a view where we're looking straight down a road and we turn our video view 90 degrees to the left, so the road now runs off to our right, then any sounds that were coming from straight ahead before when we were looking down the road are now coming to us in our right ear because we've turned 90 degrees to the left. So maybe all that kind of stuff needs to be done in real time as a real-time playback effect. And maybe that'll come one day, but I don't think we're there yet. And I'm just, I don't know. That's a kettle of fish too big for my brain to comprehend, man. So I'm sure we'll get there at some point. And someone will work out a way to make it easy, you know, for consumers to consume that content and find it enjoyable. I think if we gave people surround panners, it would never take off. Just like blue and red goggles didn't take off. that's my take on it. Anyway, that's pretty much it. There was one other thing. I got a message from Steve Hope via Facebook a couple of days ago, and I hope Steve's okay with me sharing this. He said, a question without notice. When you're producing your podcast, what's the maximum level you mix to in DBFS? For instance, for TV broadcast, the standard is lineup tone at minus 20 DBFS, maximum peak level minus 10 DBFS, although some say minus 12 DBFS. However, with podcasts, there isn't a broadcast chain. So what are the standards you use? Well, as I replied to Steve, I'm old school, so I don't have to worry about having levels that low. I still work in the headspace of a guy who produces for radio. So what I do is I aim for peaks of minus 1 dBFS. I don't like peaks to be higher than that simply because I want to know that the digital peaks will reconstruct properly in the analog realm. And I'm pretty sure I've covered that in previous episodes of Sign Language as to why you need a little bit of clearance at the top of the digital, you know, scale, if you like, to make sure that the intersample peaks aren't clipping. So peaks of minus one, and then I use a VU meter plugin. And as I've mentioned on this podcast before, I use a free plugin from Antress, A-N-T-R-E-S-S, called Modern Meter. And it's just a simple, you know, stereo VU meter plugin. It's a VST plugin. And it has a standardized 300 millisecond response time. So the ballistics of the needle respond pretty much like a real VU meter would. I've never done an A-B comparison between the plug-in and a genuine hardware VU meter, but yeah, from all my years of looking at VU meters, it seems to me that this plug-in does a pretty good job of behaving like a hardware VU meter would do. So I aim for zero VU, you know, which, you know, depending on what we call crest factor, and I've mentioned this on the podcast before as well, which is the difference between the average level and the peak level, which, you know, from what Steve is describing, is around about 10 dB of crest factor for TV, but peaks are at minus 10, not minus 1. I usually find that, you know, with the amount of compression I apply, I've probably got somewhere around about 12 dB of crest factor. I think you'd find that my peaks at minus 1 and my average would be, yeah, around minus 12-ish. So, yeah. I tend to not like peak program meters for the very fact that they're, you know, they don't behave like a VU meter. And I know I'm old school. It's just, it works for me. You know, and I've never had anyone complain about distortion of my podcasts. They reconstruct nicely and they sound loud. I've had people say they always have to turn my podcast down when my podcast comes on after somebody else's, and yet there's never any distortion. So that's a good thing. So good luck, Steve. I know Steve's producing some podcasts for a client at the moment, so hence why he was asking. And yeah, you're right. I mean, there is no broadcast chain as such, so I just go on the Yeah. The tried and true. Yeah. Minus one for peaks and zero VU, you know, RMS. That works. All right, that will do it. Thank you for the lengthy email again, Rob. Thank you also, Ernie, for your comments regarding your adventures in audio recording and video wallpaper, if you like. I'm not sure what you're planning to do with these video scapes that you're producing, but they look great. And Rob, your other email I'll get to in the next episode, so thank you for that. Chad's movie is almost... He's gone back and reworked some of the visuals, but he has promised me that no massive changes are required to the audio. I just had to extend one scene, which really just had some wind atmos, so I gave him the mixes of that. So he's going to take my mixes and just mix in the extra little bit of wind ambience that he needs for the shot that he extended. But he's saying he reckons he'll have the whole thing finished in the next week and a half. So that's pretty exciting. So I don't think I'm going to get over to Seattle to see the screening in a cinema. But Chad did say, you know, it's been absolutely epic working together, and that we will work on, you know, more stuff in the future, and that he plans to incorporate my travel to the US into the budget of any forthcoming projects that we should happen to collaborate on. So that's pretty exciting. Quora. I don't know if any of you peruse Quora at any time, but I quite like it. To me, Quora is like the best of all forums across the web. You know, it used to be that if you wanted to find experts in one particular field, you would go and find a website that was hosting a good forum, you know. And in the case of audio, that would be, you know, places like Pro Sound Web, where you used to have Mixer Man and Slipper Man and guys like those who were highly experienced recording engineers, you know, discussing all the facets of daily studio life. Or it might be you'd go to a place like Gear Sluts, where there's people discussing, you know, audio hardware and, you know, mics and preamps and compressors and all that sort of stuff. And Quora kind of brings all of that together into one place where, you know, you've got people who are generally, you know, knowledgeable in a particular field sharing their knowledge. And you can either ask a question or you can answer a question, you know, or any combination thereof. So I've been writing a few answers on, you know, some questions that are audio related and one or two that are photography related on Quora. And I just happened to be there a couple of days ago, and I was looking at my notifications, and Quora said, "You are now one of the most read authors on the subject of audio recording," which I thought was rather trippy. I have no idea what "one of" means. I don't know if that's like top 10 or top 10,000. Yeah, there's no indication as to what sort of metric they're applying to "one of the most read authors," you know. So, but anyway, I thought that was nice. Just this week, I wrote a fairly lengthy response to the question, "Why is WAV better than MP3? So I'll put a link to that story in the show notes. And, you know, if you're interested in reading any of the other stuff that I've written, you know, you'll be able to basically follow the links back to my profile and read my other answers if that interests you. But I quite enjoy Quora. So anyway, and the last thing that I wanted to mention this episode is that the free version of BitBandit is now up on the Google Play Store, as well as the pro version. I feel like I haven't really completely explained what BitBandit is, so allow me to do that. My initial idea for BitBandit was to take a spreadsheet that I authored a couple of years ago and have, you know, continued to use all along, and turn that into an app. Basically, I created a spreadsheet, and this is because as a radio engineer, I quite often receive files from external sources, and it's not always obvious to me what the sample rate and channel count is of those, you know, pieces of audio. So what I did was I created a spreadsheet in Excel, and what I could do was I could enter a sample rate, a channel count, and a bit depth, and then receive as a series of cells in Excel expressions of what they those values computed to as either kilobytes per second or megabytes per second or megabytes per minute or gigabytes per hour. Basically, I worked out all of the calculations so that you only had to input these three bits of data, and then you would get all of these output values. And most often what I was after was kilobits per second, because Windows generally will tell you the kilobit per second rate of a piece of audio without telling you the sample rate and the channel count and the bit depth and all that sort of stuff, unless you go into the advanced properties of the file, which is just tedious. So I'd created this Excel spreadsheet a couple of years ago. And then, middle of last year, whenever it was, James and I started working on this project, I went to the Google Play Store thinking someone must have already made an app that does this. And lo and behold, there was nothing in the Play Store that did this. And so initially I was going to try and create the app myself, having never written a line of code in my life. Adventurous idea. So after about 30 minutes, I realized that this was way beyond my, scope or level of understanding. So I reached out to James. James is a software developer by profession. And I said, "Hey, dude, just shared you a link with this Excel spreadsheet that I wrote. This is what it does. No, I'm not expecting you to use it. What I'm wondering is, how hard would it be to turn this into an Android app?" And so that's how the development of Bitbandit got underway. And he said, "Mate, I'm all in. I've not developed for Android, but I'd love to. And this looks like a really nice, simple project as a way of, dipping my toes in the water as a developer." And so we started collaborating on, putting this together, and, design and colors, and, obviously the algorithm was already written. It was just a case of him taking those computational algorithms and working that all into the software. So over the course of the development of the app, the functionalities changed a little bit from what I originally had in the spreadsheet. So now when you open Bitbandit, you'll see two tabs. The first tab says bitrate, and what you've got are three drop-down menus: sample rate, bit depth, and channel count. And we've gone, for the moment, we've just gone with the generally commonly used sample rates. So that's basically 8,000, 11,025, 16,000, 22,050, 32K, 44.1, 48, 88.2, 96, 176,400, 192,000. In the pro version of Bitbandit, you can also enter a custom bitrate. So if you are working with some sort of bitrate or sample rate that is outside of, that standardized list, you can enter a custom value. Then you've got bit depth, and again, we've stuck to the common ones: 4, 8, 16, 24, and 32. And channel count. Now, with the free version of Bitbandit, you get one channel and two channel. So you can basically calculate the file sizes for mono or stereo files. With the pro version of Bitbandit, that goes all the way to 64 channels. So you can use it for calculating file sizes if you're working in Dolby Atmos. It's probably way more than anybody ever wants to use, but we figured, hey, it's not that hard to incorporate it because it's just number crunching. So yeah. And then what you've got below those three, so once you've chosen those three core values of sample rate, bit depth, and channel count, you've then got the option of expressing the size, and for that you've got six options: bits, kilobits, bytes, kilobytes, megabytes, gigabytes. And then you've got three time values: second, minute, and hour. So for any given sample rate, bit depth, and channel count, you can have your output value expressed as any one of 6 cubed, whatever that comes to, 36 times 3, yeah, whatever. Over 100 different potential output values, right? So obviously, you know, for me, the most common is kilobits per second. You know, when you look at a WAV file or an MP3 file or whatever in, certainly in Windows, Windows will express it as kilobits per second, you know, so that's sort of the common starting point for me. Now, that's just the first tab. The second tab is called file size. Now, what's not immediately obvious, and we might need to work this into the... Actually, I think maybe the help file does explain this, that the file size tab retrieves the value that you've got on the bitrate tab in the bitrate section of that second tab. You go and download the free version so you know what I'm talking about. But basically, the idea of the file size tab is that you can express the length of a project that you are planning on working on in hours, minutes, and seconds, and you can choose what bitrate you want to record at. And like I said, this is where by default it retrieves the value from the first tab as a starting point. And you can calculate the hard disk space requirement for that project. So if, for example, you were going to record a band and you were going to record, you know, 20 microphones off a stage and you knew they're going to play a 45-minute set, then you could enter all that information, and based on the bitrate that you were going to record, this file size tab will output just how many kilobytes or megabytes or gigabytes of space you are going to require. So those are the two basic use cases for Bitbandit at this point in time. Like I said, the free version and the pro version are both in the Play Store right now, and I do need to check with James on where we're at with the iOS development. So anyway, just wanted to bring that to your attention. I don't know whether anybody else on the planet is going to get any use out of this or not, but I figured, hey, it's useful to me. If it's useful to me, there's got to be someone else who's going to find it useful as well. And I guess what I need to do now is really start looking for other avenues to promote Bitbandit and make it, you know, make its presence in the Play Store a little more widely known. I should be jumping onto some audio forums and spreading the word. But anyway, just thought I'd bring you up to date on where we were at with Bitbandit. All right, that will do it for this episode. Good to be back, and I will look forward to your emails, and Rob, I'll get to your other epic email in the next episode. And until then, take care.
Sign Language.
Another audiotoyou.com quality podcast. For previous episodes, check out
signlanguagepodcast.com
or search the iTunes Music Store. For questions, comments, and feedback, email studio@audiotoyou.com.